Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for downloading the Inside Lacrosse D1 podcast. I'm your host, Dan Flynn, joined as always by my man, Terry Foy. If you like what you hear, please tell a friend. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, leave a rating and a comment, and hit us up on Twitter at @D_Fly and at Terrence Foy. If you'd like to share a thought, a comment, or a question, you can always email us at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com and at tfoy@insidelacrosse.com. We apologize for no podcast last week, but we hope you checked out IL founder Bob Carpenter's conversation with legendary coach Dick Adell in advance of the inaugural IMLCA Hall of Fame induction dinner, which was this past weekend. If you didn't, you should do so right now after this one. It was great, and Bob even spoke to Coach K about the big man. You'll hear about their history, but Coach K and Coach Adell were young coaches at West Point at the same time in the early 80s and kept their relationship going when they went on to Duke and Maryland. Also, Bob talked to Syracuse legends Roy Simmons Jr., Pat McCabe, and Paul Carcaterra to celebrate the program's 100th anniversary, which was featured on the cover of the May issue of Inside Lacrosse. On today's show, we'll be discussing all the events of the past weekend in Philadelphia, including all the games, the Lacrosse Industry Summit, the very first one. We'll get into some of the All-Americans and the Tewaratin Trophy, which is tomorrow. We'll talk about games. We'll have a little bit of nonsense and banter, and we'll do our usual segments, broadcast, webcast, observation of the week, along with a Twitter follow of the week, and look at the week ahead. Terry, you ready to go?
Yeah, Dan, are you ready to go? Come on, buddy. It's championship weekend. Let's go. Whoa. We owe these folks two podcasts.
I know. We were pretty busy last week.
And oh, Danny boy.
There was one point where Terry and I were looking at each other, and it was like Wednesday already, and I was like, hey, we didn't really do a podcast yet. Are we going to do it this week? And it wasn't as if we, in previous weeks where we couldn't do one, we were just super busy, but we kind of let you know, and we tried. Last week, it was busy to the point of not even being able to think about getting around to it. So apologize for that, but it was a great weekend. What a weekend for the sport of lacrosse, Terry.
What a weekend for Inside Lacrosse.
On the field and off the field. Just a spectacular culmination to what may be the best lacrosse season that I can remember.
Don't let the cat out of the bag on that one, buddy. We're holding on to that one. TM.
Yeah. So where do you want to start, Terry?
I want to start with the Lacrosse Industry Summit because it was, I think, unlike anything else. We'll talk about the games, and they were great, and I think that, you know, a couple times over the course of the weekend, I said that, you know, as we continue to develop as a sport and as an industry, you know, our North Star needs to be the games. It needs to be the action on the field for sure. But I'm super excited about this. I'm super excited about how it went. I'm super excited about, you know, how we were able to bring together what we were trying to do. And, you know, ultimately, I think that it was a success. So I want to start with you. What was your most memorable moment of the Lacrosse Industry Summit?
I very much enjoyed meeting Dee Smith. I can see why the owners, why business people like him, as well as the players. You know, he seems to be one of those guys who's anyone can relate to, or he's able to relate to everybody. Just a great guy.
And what a charismatic dude. I mean,
that's what I mean. There's like an aura around him. There's no pretension. It's just that he's just a solid guy.
And so just to kind of take one step back, the Lacrosse Industry Summit was Friday morning and afternoon at the Lowe's Downtown Hotel. It featured seven panels, which a discussion of which ranged from technology to entrepreneurship to social media. And it began with an analysis of what lacrosse can learn from other sports, headlined by, as Dan mentioned, the executive director of the NFLPA, Demoris Smith, whose son Alex is a rising senior in high school who has committed to play lacrosse at Hartford. So D is pretty familiar and becoming more familiar with lacrosse. It also featured the chief marketing officer of Major League Soccer, Howard Handler, who played club lacrosse at the University of Michigan, as well as the chief commercial officer of PGA of America, Jeff Price, who played 2 years of college lacrosse at Bates and has familiarity with inside lacrosse from having worked with us a couple of years ago. And it was really an excellent panel. And to your point, I mean, the charisma that Dee brought to the stage was very difficult to contend with for your boy who was hosting the panel.
Terry was the moderator on that panel and did a fine job. But it is, you know, he was sitting in the middle of the three panelists, the speakers, and yeah, that guy, he's impressive. Not to say the other two guys weren't. They dropped a lot of knowledge. It was a great way to kick off the event. You know, the way we scheduled these things, it seemed to really work out, you know, topics at certain times of the day. But there was one point during halfway through the first session when I just kind of looked at another guy on our staff and said, "This is amazing." And he said, "Yeah, he was just asking." I was just talking to another guy, saying basically the same thing. It was really good. I felt I was proud of what we were able to accomplish.
And so, for those of you who feel teased by this, that's exactly what we're meant to do, because we will be posting the sessions via podcast in the coming weeks and months as we continue to transition into the off season. I think that's the perfect time to listen to some of the discussions and kind of reflect on you know, where we've come from and where, you know, as a sport and an industry surrounding a sport, we should be headed over the course of the next year. And with that, I mean, it's time to...
Well, there was one other thing I want to point out is we had about 120 people that participated. And what I was most impressed by, they came from 20 different states. So a lot of the lacrosse world was represented and in a smaller amount of people. And the panelists spoke, but the question and answer sessions were probably the most valuable to be able to be in a room with only about another 100 people and be able to ask some of these thought leaders of our sport and of sports in general in the United States questions was a very valuable and powerful experience that I think just about every attendee was able to take away some very positive stuff.
No doubt. But I also want to transition into our next tease, which is to tease our forthcoming podcast, which we'll be treated to next week, hopefully in a more timely fashion than this one. And that is, we'll digest the All-Americans, particularly the D1 All-Americans and the Tewarton winners. As you mentioned, Dan, we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, and the Tewarton ceremony is set for Thursday evening. You know, Dylan Malloy is a heavy, heavy favorite coming off of a Final Four appearance in which he came back from a broken foot to score two goals.
Amazing.
It was unbelievable.
So I told you this. I saw him on the street probably about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night on Thursday night. I was just walking to get something to eat.
You realize you may be blowing up a spot. That could be post-bed check.
No, it was still early enough. But he was only with one other guy, and he had a boot on, and he had his little scooter that he was rolling down. You know, it was like next to his hotel. It was right outside his hotel.
Roll right down Broad Street.
God. <They're, laughs> we'll get to that later. There was no chance. I told people on Friday, I saw him last night. There is no chance he can play. I was stunned when I saw him suited up and on the field, and he didn't play poorly either. What are the odds? What are the current odds, in your opinion, of him to win it? Is it like a
1-1?
1-1?
Yeah, you don't make any money on Dylan Malloy winning the tour today.
So like plus 1,000? You bet 100 to get 1,000?
It's the opposite. You bet 1,000 to win 100?
Yeah.
You're a gambling whiz over there, Dan Flynn. Regular bookmaker.
I know.
It's been a long week. We're going to try to rebound. No, yeah.
But he's that heavy of a favorite.
Yeah, okay. The last thing we want to touch on before transitioning to one non-lacrosse related point is, you know, this is a D1 podcast. It's called the Inside Lacrosse D1 Podcast. But we'd be remiss not to mention how great Sunday was. And the theme and thread that emerged to me, Maryland came in chasing a dynasty on the women's side. Mm-hmm. Limestone came in chasing a dynasty on the D2 side, and Tufts did on the D3 side as well. It was amazing to me that all three fell short in this successive order. And the comment that I want to make is, after the D3 championship, which was the middle game, so to speak, even though it had started before the women's game and ended, McNear, who was doing color commentary for the webcast on the D2 game, said to me, "Well, Limestone's ought to be put on notice a little nervous after Salisbury felled Tufts. And I was like, why? Those two things are completely mutually independent, mutually exclusive. And his point was, doesn't it feel like these things kind of have the momentum of their own or a little bit of a weight to them? And I totally disagree. It's no, they're completely independent. It's
insane. Happened in threes.
Yeah. And that was apparently the way it shook out. So, you know, tremendous tip of the cap to the North Carolina Tar Heel, women's Tar Heel team. I mean, in that situation, in that instance, they were, I mean, just thoroughly dominant. It was one of those cases where looking away from it, you know, I'm a believer that the best team doesn't always win a championship. It's why there's a difference between the term best team and the term champion. But in this case, despite the fact that Maryland came in undefeated and off of a two-time defending national championship resume, North Carolina just looked like the better team. And that was not what I think most people expected. I think that those who allowed themselves to entertain the idea of North Carolina knocking off Taylor Cummings and her Terps believed that it was going to be, you know, a nip and tuck, maybe break goes their way late in the game type of situation. It was not that at all. And Megan Ward, so impressive in net. I believe she finished with 12 saves in what I think was a 13-7 victory.
Yeah, 13-7.
And oh my, were some of those saves awesome. You know, Kyle Bernlohr took a few notes from Megan Ward given his performance on Monday afternoon. And then similarly with the way that, you know, Salisbury continued to build and maintain, Tufts made a late run, but the work that the Seagulls had done earlier in the game was ultimately what spelled the difference. And then, you know, with Lemoyne, even though the game was lower scoring, it was similarly paced and similarly controlled. I think the thing that was most impressive early for Lemoyne was, you know, there was a lot of attention paid to Matt Taylor, who, you know, was 7 years removed from his high school senior season after being on the roster for four, playing two seasons at Cornell, taking a year to work, and then coming back to Lemoyne, playing in 2015 and then playing again in 2016. This guy played his final game as a college player, to his knowledge, three times. It's not something you get to do more than once, typically, and to be able to end it on a championship, particularly after being pretty instrumental in the way that Lemoyne was able to score early and kind of set the tone for the game. But really, you know, I think this is represented in the sophomore defense in Chatterton winning the most outstanding player. You know, it was what Lemoyne's defense was able to do to Limestone offensively, a really high-powered offense that I thought, you know, kind of spelled the outcome of that game.
Terry, do we want to get right into the semifinal games?
Yes.
Okay. What happened to your Greyhounds in the first semifinal? Carolina wins 18-13. I think it was 12-2 and 14-4 and 14-5 at halftime. But what Carolina did from the start of that game was almost like something I've never seen before.
It was amazing, and I think that there are kind of two facets. The first is, I think that the margin, and I think, you know, you look at the way that the last couple of minutes unfolded, it felt like it should have been a 17-14 final. And so a three-goal margin feels like a game that you can explain either team being able to win. But anybody who watched that game, when it was 12-2, I was thinking to myself, on the podcast, I'm going to try to make an argument that the game could have unfolded a certain way and Loyola would have won. And people are going to think I'm crazy because there's a 10-goal margin of victory right now. But hear me out. So, you know, first things first, Loyola has the ball. You could argue that the ref is out of position. Loyola midfielder runs in to him, drops the ball, gets called for a trip. Other end of the field, different Loyola player called for a trip. Greyhounds go two men down. Carolina scores to go up 1-0 on a two-man advantage. You know, it's a great way to get out of the gate if you're a high-scoring Carolina team. You know, it's a little bit of a bummer if you're a Loyola team that felt like it needed to seize momentum, certainly carry on what had developed the 2 weeks prior with the wins over Duke and Towson. Carolina scores two more quick goals and then also had established a little bit of dominance at the faceoff X as well. The subsequent draw, Graham Savio wins back to himself. Loyola sets up to clear. Jake Stover is out of the net. For a team that had already been called for two tripping penalties to not get a tripping call when Graham Savio was brought down from behind, lost the ball, Carolina picked it up and scored on an empty net. If I were the coach, and I think I would be a pretty level-headed coach on the sideline, but in that situation, given the way that the first 4 or 5 minutes had unfolded, I would have lost my mind. So, I misspoke. Loyola had scored to cut the deficit to 3-1. That made it 4-1 and gave the momentum back to Carolina. And as you said, at that point, it was just a deluge. I mean, the thing that really impressed me most over the course of the next 25 minutes was simply how much faster North Carolina was than Loyola in all three phases of the game. Felt like, you know, particularly Stephen Pontrello and Luke Oldstock could run past their matchups in ways that we had not been able to see previously. And to a degree, that might say a little bit about Duke and Towson in terms of why the matchup was appealing, why those matchups were appealing for Loyola. You know, both of those two teams are a little bit more in the way that they're dodging oriented, midfield dodging oriented. Certainly Duke is. It's probably less true for Towson, but, you know, it kind of suggests to me that Loyola's speed defensively is at the defensive midfield, and maybe they're a little bit more power-oriented and position-oriented defensively. But, yeah, I mean, it builds out to a 12-2 lead, and it felt like, you know, curtains, that's all she wrote.
They looked
from that point on, they outscored Carolina 11-6. Now, you obviously suggest that, you know, it was the Tar Heels taking their foot off the gas, and that's certainly a reasonable conclusion, but you know, it was weird how much that speed advantage didn't feel like it was the deciding factor in the game over the course of the next 20 minutes, 30 minutes.
I just felt so sorry for Jacob Stover. He wasn't getting a lot of help, but he was just getting destroyed. They looked unorganized. They looked like they always had a man down, even when they didn't. And that if you just got together some really good club players, you know, like an adult, and throw them out there without really a lot of and I don't want to, you know, that's how good Carolina played. They looked like they were unorganized, and they weren't communicating well, and they weren't talking well, and it just compounded as they scored goal after goal after goal. And at the same time, Carolina was playing loose as can be, just letting it fly, knowing that it's going to go in. I don't think Stover, he made two saves.
He allowed 9 goals in 15 minutes and then was replaced by Grant Lamone after the first quarter, yeah. Which, you know, was one of those situations where I think Charlie probably didn't disagree with you, loyal coach Charlie Toomey, but he felt like this is a three-year investment. This is something that I need to essentially save this kid from the way that his season could end.
He's great.
Yeah. He was above 60% heading into this. And, you know, there were a couple of folks on Twitter, reputable, former, you know, D1 players who played in NCAA tournament games, Final Four games, that suggested that, you know, a bad end to your season early in your career can have long-lasting effects. And I think that this was a choice made with an eye toward avoiding those negative effects. But we can't talk about this game without talking about Chris Cloutier.
What a game.
I mean, you know, first of all,
what a weekend for this kid.
Yeah, so he broke the all-time NCAA tournament goals record held by Eric Lusby, who I believe had 17 in 2012. He broke Paul Gates' record, I believe, of 16. I don't know what year that was set. Probably 89? Chris Cloutier, I believe, finished with 19 goals in the tournament in total, and he had 9.
Yeah, that was the semifinal record, championship weekend record, too.
It was unbelievable. So, you know, here you go. In a year when, you know, the Canadians had not dominated the goal scoring charts like they had over the course of probably, you know, 8 out of the previous 10 years, you know, it wasn't a conversation really about like who were the best shooters in the game. Well, there were a couple of catch and finish guys, there were a couple of wing shooters, and they were Canadians that were just, you know, head and shoulders above the rest. I mean, it was interesting to me how that balance shifted over the course of the year. You know, clearly the star that emerged at the end of the season was, you know, a lefty, wears a big number, 45, number that a lot of Canadians are familiar with, and that kid knows how to run through traffic, get his shot off, catch and finish. I mean, he's got the full arsenal. And I think what was interesting for so many, particularly people who had followed Carolina over the course of the season, was that it wasn't a question of how high Chris Cloutier's heights could be. It was a question of how consistently he could get there. Because you look at his score line, there were a couple of 5-goal games, and there were a couple of 0-goal games as well. And so I think what was most impressive to folks who are familiar with this Carolina team was the fact that he consistently showed up over the course of the tournament, and particularly on the last 2 days.
Yeah. Shout out to Pat Spencer. 1 goal, 5 assists. That's a 6-point game, and it's just sort of not the talking point, you know, coming out of it. A great season for the Greyhounds.
And I want to talk a little bit about how they're shaping up going forward, because with a freshman goalie and a freshman star attackman who, you know, many feel should have been a first-team All-American, clearly there's an eye toward Loyola being good not only next year but for the next 3 years, and I certainly think that that's possible. I think that that's likely. But on the other hand, I do think that starting with Zach Harawires, those who are immediately penciling Loyola into any finishing position next season, be it Patriot League champs, NCAA tournament appearance, maybe even back to the Final Four, you know, have to realize that replacing a 50-goal scorer, another Canadian, probably the guy who over the course of the season had been the best offensive Canadian player in my book, at least for a top-tier NCAA tournament competitive program, you know, that's a tall order, and there isn't an heir apparent for Loyola. And in addition to that, Tyler Albrecht is a first-line midfielder. Jeff Chase is a very important part of this team. David Manning, and the way that he reinvigorated that offense that struggled at times last year, and I think in many instances was the reason that Loyola turned, I believe, seven one-goal losses in 2015 into as many one-goal wins in 2016. You know, this is a program that in the 2010s has been among the best. Obviously, they are now one of four teams to have won a championship. I'm sorry, one of five teams, Carolina, Virginia, Denver, and Duke being the others. But they also you know, have made it to the NCAA tournament, I believe, four out of seven years, yeah, 2010 to 2016. Five out of seven, and made their second visit to the Final Four with, you know, two others that I think they're, you know, kind of still kicking themselves about. Tremendous tip of the cap to the Greyhounds on this season, and very excited to see not only the emergence of the star freshman. There are a couple of other guys on this team that I really liked. Foster Huggins and Jack Kerrigan, the other two close defensemen, are awesome. Brian Sherlock, who, you know, I didn't think had quite as good of a year this year as he had the previous two, is also awesome. It was an interesting dynamic watching him play, you know, some of his old teammates. He got called for that early trip and then, you know, got into a couple of scraps also over the course of the game. But, you know, that's what you get out of that kind of emotional guy. And then, you know, there are a couple of guys that are coming in. Ryan McNulty, chief among them, an Under Armour All-American, who, you know, folks on Cold Spring Lane are very, very excited about.
Terry, let's talk about your broadcast observation of the week. You want to give a shout out to some people at ESPN?
I do. So, you know, clearly there were no webcasts this week, given that all three D1 games were broadcast on ESPN2. And we've talked about a lot of the ESPN broadcasts over the course of the season, but two guys who I really like have been very good to me over the course of my time at Inside Lacrosse, and one of whom is on air, one of whom is not, that deserve a special tip of the cap. Anish Shroff was your pilot for the weekend, the studio host, taking it in and out of the games. He was down in Charlotte and started the weekend well with a article on the Undefeated, which is a new sub-site, so to speak, of ESPN.com that primarily focuses on minority issues in sports. And, you know, Anish, who was born in the United States, raised in New Jersey, you know, comes from non-American descent, and has a very acute understanding of minority issues, as well as an acute understanding of lacrosse. And so the lens and perspective that he was able to lend to that issue was appropriately placed on the Undefeated. And I think, you know, he continues to be a voice to push that conversation forward. And I think that that's something that he deserves a lot of credit for, in addition to how seriously and professionally he approaches taking in and out all the lacrosse content that we consume over the course of the season. And for those of you who are Game of Thrones fans, I would imagine that he also is very enjoyable because of his almost constant allusions to Game
show.
Of Thrones.
It's a good show.
I just don't watch it. I'm sorry. And then the second is John Kettering, who is a producer and was up in Philadelphia manning the truck and you know, he's just a champion for lacrosse at ESPNU. We've talked about John Vassallo on this podcast, you know, and he currently carries the torch in Charlotte for lacrosse. You know, John is essentially JV's right-hand guy, and he's, you know, a little bit of the boots on the ground, making it happen and making it look good, and he cares. He cares about lacrosse, and I really, really appreciate that, and I think it's something that lacrosse fans should as well. But generally speaking, just a total dime drop to, you know, all the folks at ESPNU for the job that they did this weekend. I think it was, you know, a really, really enjoyable broadcast, and I think that the fans noticed. The response that I saw certainly suggests that it did not go unnoticed.
Yeah, it was obviously a little bit enhanced than what they are normally doing. The budget was probably bigger. You know, I love having the field mic'd up, and you can really hear the crowd and some of the calls from the field. And the goalie cam was great.
How about when the ball hit the goalie cam? I think that was one of Harawire's goals. I had no idea what happened. The ball went in and out of the net so fast that and all of a sudden guys were like battling for the rebound, and then the ref blew the whistle. First of all, tip of the cap to the ref for noticing what happened, because I wouldn't have if I were in his position, I don't think. And then secondly, who would have thought that you put a goalie cam in the net and the first game you use it for, yeah, it gets hit with a shot. And actually, I mean, that was a really cool visual.
Yeah, so great job on a great season. As a lacrosse fan, you know, I don't know what I'd do without ESPN and their family of networks to keep us going. Terry, that second game on Saturday was unbelievable. An instant classic. Maryland beats Brown 15-14 in overtime. So many just great plays all the way around. And the Terps advanced to the finals again. Let's talk about the game, but let's also talk about how much fun it was to watch that game and Brown in particular all season long.
Well, nobody put it better than Coach Lars Tiffany, who made a comment in the post-game press conference that elicited a response that none of us in the press have ever seen before. He said, as soon as he sat down, how much fun was that? And this is a guy who just had his dream season, you know, program's first trip to the Final Four since, I believe, 1994, so 22 years. Mm-hmm. And it elicited applause from the press corps. I've never seen that before. It was awesome, and it was appropriate. And, you know, I think that we talked about Dylan Malloy earlier, and I think that it did start with just how awesome his emergence on the field was. As soon as the Brown fans saw him take his first step.
It's like when Willis Reed came out of the New York Knicks locker room.
It was wild, man. And I was underneath the stadium at the time and wasn't able to see it, but I did see the social media reaction. And, you know, the when your best player comes back and you've got all these goals and you're so excited about your prospects, and then it just, there he is, takes a step onto the field, and you feel like, oh, man, here we go. Here we go. It was such a jolt of energy. And so, you know, continues through warm-ups, and then got on the board early and put his shoulder into, I believe it was Matt Dunn who was guarding him at the time, hit him twice, did an inside roll, nice lefty finish, put it off hip. And what was so amazing to me about that goal was that it had to have hurt a lot more than if he had set up from behind and tried to speed his way through somebody or even just finish on the run with an inside roll. And you know, but to actually, like, put your foot in the dirt and push into somebody and put all that weight, all that pressure onto your broken foot. Man, a lot of toughness there. But the thing about this game that emerges to me, there are two numbers that stick out that I think are representative of how much fun it was, why it was so much fun. And I think that they both reflect the fact that Maryland engaged. They didn't play afraid. And that's a criticism that we've heard from Maryland over the course of the last 5 years, is that sometimes they play conservatively without reason. And that was not the case. This game featured 76 combined ground balls. That's a lot. That is a lot, a lot. You typically see that number hover more close to 50. When the ball's on the ground, and this is something that you'll hear a lot of traditionalists say, that's when the game is at its most exciting. The second number was Brown only took 29 shots. This is a team that over the course of the season and over the course of the last 2 years has really made its bones getting up and down the field, playing high possession games. Their games have featured the most possessions of any team in college lacrosse over the last 2 years. And to have only taken 29 shots is remarkable, because this is a team that you would expect to be closer to its average, which is 40 plus. what's even more remarkable than that is that they scored 14 goals. Kyle Brunlor made 11 saves, which means they got 25 of their 29 shots on cage. They missed the goal four times. You know what? I want you to talk, Dan, because I'm going to check the website right now and make sure that that's correct. Because that I already checked it once when I wrote it down, but I want to make sure that it's fully correct and I'm not saying something foolish.
Okay. Terry, do you have the 76 ground balls combined?
Yeah.
Which you said is almost 50% more than in a normal game. What is the cause of that? Why would you say that?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, there were 29 goals, which means that there were 32 or 33 faceoffs. And, you know, so that accounts for a little bit more than a third of the faceoffs. So that was significant. But I also think that because Brown plays defense so aggressively and they check so hard and they get the ball on the ground so successfully and so consistently, you know, the ball has to get picked up.
But there were just some plays in that game, like a long pole passing into a long pole for a goal. In transition, great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There were great saves. Jack Kelly was fantastic at times in goal for Brown. Just plays all over the field. It went to overtime.
So here's my comment about the fact that it went to overtime. Well, first of all, just in terms of you know, the way that the first half unfolded, it was nip and tuck, and it never got beyond a two-goal advantage. And then it was a one-goal Maryland lead at half. However, what was crazy to me is if I had told you that there was 17 combined goals in the first half, you would have thought, first of all, I would assume that you would have believed that Brown was winning something to the effect of 12-5. And so when I told you that not only is it's a one-goal game, but Maryland's winning, I think people's jaws would have hit the floor. And I think that my attitude at that point is this has to favor Brown. This pace has to favor Brown because at some point Maryland's going to get outside of their comfort zone, and whether it's start making mistakes or whatever else, the game is going to tip in the Terps' favor. And that didn't end up being the case. And over the course of the third quarter, Maryland really settled down defensively and built a 12-8 lead with 2.5 minutes to go in the third quarter. You know, it was a Bailey Tills unassisted goal at the end of the third that I felt like prevented the game from getting out of hand for Brown. I felt like one more Maryland goal to make it 13-8. And, you know, this is an uninteresting fourth quarter. It might be a little bit too steep of a hill for them to climb. Fortunately, you know, despite the fact that it did get to a four-goal advantage, Brown had, in the interim, cut it to 12-10. And I think that because they got that close, when Maryland responded with two more goals over the subsequent 2 minutes, you know, kind of they scored with 11 minutes to go and 9.5 minutes to go, Brown still believed. And I think that their fans quickly started to believe as well, and they were able to reel off four goals to end the fourth quarter and take the game to overtime. Dan, what was your thought on Colin Heacock's overtime goal? I mean, you know, was there anything about the way that it unfolded that stands out in your memory, or is there anything about, you know, how Maryland was able to kind of possess the ball, get a look, finish it, and all of a sudden move on to the national championship game?
What I was impressed with was Maryland's poise. You know, Will Gural wins the faceoff. Maryland strips him of the ball and then is patient enough to get off a good shot. Brian Cole skipped a pass to Matt Rambo, who found Heacock open on the crease. And
there was a lot of unselfishness on that play.
Yeah, that's the Terps all season, and that's why they won 16 games in a row and got to the national championship game. And were almost, I mean, right there was their unselfishness and their teamwork.
Well, let's transition to the national championship game.
Sure. Terry, that was one of the best games maybe the best championship game I've ever seen. And I don't remember a lacrosse game, even though we just talked about one, that was any better than the Maryland-North Carolina game on Monday. Just fun to watch. Again, we said it was a wild season, and to have the sort of number one seed playing an unseeded team, former like conference rivals meeting in the championship game, was fitting end.
So I want to talk specifically just to start about the quality of the game, and particularly in the context of other championship games. So I think the two that stand out the most in people's minds and memories and the ones that come up most in conversation are the 89 Syracuse Hopkins Championship. And then, you know, one that has kind of held a special place in my heart was the 2003 Virginia Hopkins. That was the championship game, right? Tillman Johnson, or was that a semifinal?
That was a semifinal. Well, it was 2005, and it was a semifinal.
No, that so that was
the one where Hopkins comes back.
Yeah, yeah. No, that I'm referring to. It was a. The big Tillman Johnson save performance game.
I think
the
that
one
was
in the
a semi. That was a semifinal game.
Yeah. So, so then, really, the other two championship games that stand out in my memory. It's funny because you know the chronologically the going backwards from the right. point in time now is the 2010 Duke Notre Dame 6-5 overtime game, which was really unremarkable in terms of the pace and one of the things that actually, you know, kind of precipitated the conversation around the shot clock sure. most dramatically.
Yeah.
But then also the year prior, the 2009 Syracuse-Cornell game in which Syracuse rebounded from a 9-6 deficit and won in overtime after one of the most remarkable, you know, game-tying goals to end regulation. But both those games clearly have flaws. I mean, you know, the first 60 minutes of Duke Notre Dame were not particularly memorable and enjoyable. And then in the case of the Syracuse Cornell game, I mean, the fact that, you know, one of those teams kind of fell apart at the end of the game impacts the quality in a negative way. You know, this was a game, Carolina, Maryland, where both teams just kept throwing punches. In the middle of the kind of scramble at the end of the fourth quarter when both teams had possession, both had an over and back. I tweeted that it felt like a 15-round heavyweight fight in which both teams were dazed, but neither was deterred. And, you know, ultimately it ended up with a crazy sequence at the end of regulation, a couple of crazy sequences in overtime, and let's kind of dive right in.
Yeah, so, I mean, the crazy sequences at the end, Colin Heacock has a about a minute and 23 seconds left in the game, has a on the doorstep, hits the pipe. You know, the penalties at the end of the game, you know, Carolina won in overtime and started a man down for 53 seconds.
It was amazing. So that was on the heels of a Brian Balcombe save. So with 3 seconds to, or 4 seconds to go, Matt Rambo catches on the doorstep. Balcombe makes an unbelievable save. In the ensuing scrum, Rambo ends up getting pushed, but legally getting pushed into the crease. So, you know, Carolina gets possession for being in the crease. I was confused at the time as to why it wasn't a free clear. I thought that Carolina, it could have been interference with the goalie, and Carolina should have gotten the ball at midfield. While the refs are restarting, and they did not allow a quick restart, at the other end of the field, Mike McCarney and Luke Goldstock are exchanging cross checks essentially, and Goldstock gets called for an unsportsmanlike, and that gives the ball to Maryland. Man up with 3 seconds to go, they decide to carry the extra man into overtime so they don't put a shot on net. They start with the ball in overtime, and it was like, at so many points did it feel like an open step down. And it ended with Connor Kelly from the top righty alley with a big right-handed step down. The closeout from Zach Powers, a long stick who dove at the ball, was so emblematic of how much heart Carolina played with, not just in the championship game, but over the course of the last 3 games of the season. Brian Balcombe catches it in the cup, comes up with the rebound. Talking to Jake Manti after the game, I was just like, what did it feel like when, and I hate that question, what did it feel like, but he had a good answer, so I'm sharing it. What did it feel like when you saw the ball come out and you knew that within 1 second, within, you know, a fraction of a second, your season, your college career was going to be over, or you were going to have to, like, continue to play the game? Like, in that moment, I don't know how your brain functions. And he said, my heart stopped. And I don't know if that, you know, that sounds exaggerated. But at the same time, it took literally about the time of a heartbeat in order for the ball to get from his stick to his goalie. And then he was just like, then it was time to clear the crease. And I thought it was awesome. So Carolina, you know, clears the ball, sets up for its own overtime possession. And there is a unbelievable Chris Cloutier shot on the doorstep. maybe the best save I've ever seen out of Kyle Brunlohr, as he is way off of the goal line. He's a lefty, and the shot was coming from the right-handed side. So he windshield wipers over to the top, and he gets just an unbelievable doorstep save right in his stick. He's in the air while doing it. Comes down with the ball. There is an ensuing scrum around the ball, and in what some, particularly Carolina fans, might call karmic, McCarney clears out Goldstock and gets called for a cross check, and Carolina goes man up. But it wasn't over, because Brunlohr had one more save in him. Carolina got the ball back, and then Chris Cloutier with a lefty step down. I mean, you know, it was appropriate that guy ended the game, but it was unbelievable. I mean, it was just an unbelievable finish. And, you know, it did feel like it happened suddenly, which is appropriate, I guess, because it's called sudden death overtime. But the ensuing emotion and reaction, the elation out of Carolina seemed like maybe a 7 or an 8 out of 10. You know, but the despair out of Maryland, oh, man, that really, it was hard to watch. It was hard to watch.
And it always is. You know, it's one of the beauties of sports, and it's just only one team can win, you know.
And the beauty is that you care that much about something that it can hurt that bad when it ends.
It's all the time and the work and, you know, getting there 2 years in a row for the Terps and coming up empty, and it's tough. But the Carolina, you referenced before, you were on the field after the game. You did some interviews. Great work, by the way. But the composure and the thoughtfulness of some of the Carolina players was just remarkable to hear. You know, I think it was Stephen Kelly talking about his family's history at the school. You know, his two cousins are on the team. His uncle, Brian, was honored on the field at halftime for playing on the 91 Carolina championship team, and how those guys, you know, saw him in the huddle or at the tunnel when they're coming out, and what that meant to them. And just, again, the maturity, the composure of those kids in those moments. Great interviews. I recommend everybody go to InsideTheCross.com and see Terry's on-field interviews.
Well, so you mentioned Stephen Kelly, and there was one aspect of I kind of coupled that with Charles Kelly interview. So Stephen Kelly is a junior faceoff specialist.
Not related,
which is amazing. And Stephen Kelly had a good season facing off, and as a result, Charles Kelly, who was a very highly recruited freshman, didn't get a ton of time. Stephen Kelly's style is very unique at the faceoff X. He's not an incredibly sound tactician, but he is very athletic, and he's very scrappy, and
he was high school running back.
Yeah.
Awesome.
He's very good at losing the draw and winning the faceoff, coming up with the ground ball. And against Austin Henningsen early in the game against Maryland, it wasn't happening. And Maryland started to really control possession after Carolina had built a 4-0 lead. And I was impressed by how impressive I was impressed by how nice a job Stephen Kelly did expressing the fact that it was disappointing that he wasn't playing well. He cleared stepped aside, allowed Charles Kelly to come in, kind of stabilized things for Carolina in terms of their faceoff play. And then he was able to come back in the game and be effective late in the game. And so, first of all, you know, a credit to both of them for being able to explain that situation, and a credit to Stephen for being able to have the wherewithal to be able to rebound like that. You know, there were a couple other comments that I wanted to share from those post-game interviews, though. You know, Patrick Kelly, one of my theories, one of my things about Carolina lacrosse over the recent past has been, you know, because for two reasons. The first is, I think it's sneaky difficult to be a member of the Carolina lacrosse team in the Bresci era, because prior to that, the team had a reputation for being very, I don't know what the right word is, but feels like carefree.
I was going to say carefree
is one of those terms, and you know, there has been a lot of attention paid to how Bresci's arrival has triggered a new era, a new mindset, a new shift, and it was symbolized by 6 a.m. practices. I think that combined with the fact that the reason for that, why it needs to occur, is because Chapel Hill is such a beautiful place. The culture of the university is so much fun. The other sports on campus have been so successful that it's hard to make some of the sacrifices necessary in order to be successful, particularly late in the season and in the NCAA tournament. That's been my outsider's view. Now, in retrospect, it's possible that they just had a series of bad breaks. But I always felt like it was going to take something special to get over that hump, and I was going to find it being attributable to an individual leader. If not an individual leader, then a group of leaders or a story. I think that I was... That's why I had such high expectations for the 2013 team, because I was of the opinion that Marcus Holman was that leader, that he would be able to do that for that team. I think that the story that people point to, justifiably, rightly, is the amount of emotion that this team took away from visiting Michael Brushy's grave prior to their quarterfinal matchup, which was played at Ohio Stadium, where Joe Brushy was the coach prior to going back to his alma mater, North Carolina, and hence where Michael died when Brush was the head coach for the Buckeyes. And my understanding of the way that the situation unfolded is that Patrick Kelly, a senior Calvert Hall alum, midfielder who put on quite the show with his right-to-left split against a long stick in the middle of the fourth quarter. I mean, it was a instructional video for how to execute that maneuver. Was super impressed. I think Patrick Kelly is one of the guys that deserves a lot of credit for the way that this team continued to move forward and carried that emotion from the quarterfinals into the Final Four and ultimately into the championship game. And I thought that he eloquently explained how he tried to attack that challenge. And then the last one, Brian Holman, a volunteer assistant for this team who came down with Brush, Marcus Holman's father. His daughter Sydney is a member of the women's team who suffered her second ACL tear during the middle of this season, and has a very clear perspective as a result on what it means for both programs to win national championships. And I thought that you saw the emotion that he was feeling, when I asked him about how he tried to put that into perspective. And I thought that his emotion was very cool and something that makes you understand a little bit more what it takes to win a championship, because it does feel like it was that emotion that allowed Carolina to play with the heart and toughness that ultimately ended up deciding the factor.
Yeah, so what a year, what a season. Fitting championship game, conclusion to it, and from my takeaways from this weekend, Terry, outstanding product on the field. And some of the things that we took part in off the field, we didn't even mention the IMLCA Hall of Fame dinner, which took place about on Saturday night at the Lowe's Hotel. Had about 260 guests there to honor 11 of the greatest college coaches of all time. That was a really cool affair as well. So some of the off the field things as well as the on the field stuff, what a positive, fun weekend. And the sport of lacrosse seems to be in a good spot.
No question. And I think that there are going to be, we saw a lot of indicators, and I think there will be more indicators that come out in the coming days, and we'll spend some time talking about that on a future podcast.
Terry, the week ahead. Let's talk about next week's games.
Cascade Maverick calendar is it's a little barren right now.
It is.
And this is the part of the podcast where we get sad.
Yeah. If you want a fix, you can watch the NLL games, NLL championships, be on Friday night?
Saturday night. Yep.
Buffalo's playing Saskatchewan. And then you can always check out the MLL as well.
Maybe lacrosse.
There's still probably some good high school lacrosse being played in the Northeast, but we finished up down here a while ago. Man, we need some music to take us out of this.
I'll take care of that in post.
I will remember you. Will you remember me?
Terry, Twitter follow the week. I have a note here. At one point on Monday, 10 of the 18 trending topics had to do with a lacrosse game.
Yeah, and that was one of the positive indicators that I referred to. I mean, that's pretty significant for us.
Yeah, and again, I went to high school with non-lacrosse people. I have a text chain with my buddies. We talk about sports nonstop, politics, life, everything. Not a lot of lacrosse talked on that text chain with my high school friends, except on Saturday and Monday when that's all that was happening. Again, it's almost like a trending topic on Twitter to have those guys talking about lacrosse, watching the game, being fascinated by the game, enjoying it. Again, a positive sign in a weird way. Like, the buzz from this weekend was palpable.
To and I have to believe that that's something that a lot of people on this podcast experienced as well. Yeah. I certainly did.
All right, Terry, it's time for new words to live by.
Yeah, it felt like, this was one, given that we were coming off of a championship weekend and given that Villanova's men's basketball team visited the White House last week, you know, it's something to cure the sadness, if you will, and it's a idea of the fact that nothing can end without another beginning coming around the horizon. And Jay Wright, after the buzzer beater, said that when you're a coach, you're always thinking about the next play. And so when you're a lacrosse fan, you can always think about the next game. Dan, it's been a pleasure.
It has, Terry.
We've got a lot more to talk about, so we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening, and we'll check you out on the other side of the Torton.
All right. Have a good week, everybody.